give us wisdom tonight as we hear the word and from your various disciples and your various deeds and throughout the centuries, and let us hope that today, tonight's word gives us wisdom but also the knowledge to do what's right. In Jesus' name.
In Jesus' name.
Amen.
So, recapping chapter 6, right? Started out, so we said at the beginning of this Bible study that chapters 1 through 6 are like a big, like, rebuke for wrong behaviors. And then 7 through the rest of the book is instructions and answering questions that he's been asked, and I guess in a letter somewhere. But reviewing chapter 6 talks about how we're supposed to handle, like, non-criminal grievances with other believers. We're not supposed to do it publicly. We're supposed to do it within the confines of our community. We talked about how some of the other denominations of Christians are really good at this, like Mennonites, was what Jarvis brought up, and then who are the other ones? The Quakers?
Amish.
And then
Shakers.
Just because things are legal doesn't mean that they're profitable and that they're good for you. So now we're going to move into chapter 7. Mm-hmm. And this is kind of broken up into three sections. It's kind of a long chapter. The beginning of it is like the principles in marriage. Yeah, get down. You're too good. First Corinthians chapter 7.
Chapter 7. Do you need glasses?
No. Yep, chapter 7, we're talking about, it's three sections. So, like, the first section is, like, the principles for marriage. The second section is like, living in the contentment of the life that you have. He brings up, like, slavery, and he brings up, like, singleness in the second part. And then the third part is kind of guidance or wisdom for those that are unmarried or widowed. And so, anybody have any opening statements, questions? Anybody read it ahead of time? Yeah, cool. Thank you. So here we go. Let's start with verse 1. Concerning the matters about which you wrote, so he's responding to a question that he's been asked in the form of a letter. It is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman. But because of the temptation to sexual immorality, each man should have his own wife, and each woman her own husband. The husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights, and likewise the wife to her husband. For the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. Likewise the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. I don't know if I like the ESV writing of that, because he's saying something pretty intimate here. So, in previous Thursday night discussions, we've talked about how one of the mistakes the Corinthian church was making was asceticism, which means they can attain, you know, holiness in how they live morally, versus, like, through being cleansed with Jesus and being changed by him.
You know, and King James said it's good for a man not to touch a woman, which has a whole different meaning for me, you know.
So it caused confusion, and so modern translators, based on chapter verse 2, changed that to make it more clear that it's talking about sexual touching, not just handshaking or whatever.
Yeah. Because chapter 6 ends with him saying, like, flee that porneia, that sexual immorality. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely talking about, like, sex here, but we said earlier how they had a problem with asceticism, and they've kind of dealt with two extremes as far as, like, sex goes. They've had this extreme where somebody was committing some act so heinous that even the Gentiles don't do it, and they were allowing this person to continue to be in the church and to be called a brother. But now we're seeing this opposite thing happen, where some of these Corinthians are under the impression that, like, you can be more holy if you avoid sex. And they're using that in their marriages. And Paul is correcting this and saying, like, no, don't do that. You're supposed to enjoy each other. Like, it says, like, you give her wife her due diligence, I think is what the King James says.
Due benevolence.
Her due benevolence, right. That's a very intimate thing. Like, she is owed pleasure from her husband. if for no other reason, just an act of service and love. And he brings up that she's owed that first before he is. But he has also owed that from her. And then he says later on, well, let's just keep going for here for a second. Like, don't deprive one another, except perhaps by agreement for a limited time. This is verse 5. That you can devote yourselves to prayer, but then come back together again so that Satan may not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. So he's addressing this group within the church here that, you know, thought it was more holy to, like, not have sex while they're still married. But Paul is clearly, like, a wise guy here. He's saying, like, listen, that's not sustainable. You're going to fall into temptation. Like, don't do this. You owe your wife to please her. She owes you to please you. Don't stop doing that unless it's agreed upon by both of you. And only stop it for a season, a short time, so that you guys can pray and fast in that regard. But then, afterwards, he says, go back together again. Aaron, you look like you had something to say, but I could have been wrong.
I was just going to say that with verse 5, he makes it clear that depriving each other is a form of fasting. That's it. Because okay. You're forgetting needs of the flesh in order to devote yourself and increase your relationship with God.
Mm-hmm. So verse 6, now as a concession, not a command, I say this. And I think, what version?
He says, but I speak this with permission and not of commandment.
Mm-hmm. I wish that all were as I myself am, but each has his own gift from God, one of one kind and one of another kind. He's talking about the gift of being in a marriage or the gift of being single. Some of us don't think singleness is a gift. And when he says that I wish that you were all as myself, we assume that Paul was a widower. It's also possible, I haven't checked historically, like historical things, but it's also possible that he had that wild conversion and that he became so sold out for God after being a member of the Sanhedrin, after being somebody that actively, like, persecuted Christians, that perhaps his wife left him because she wouldn't convert. So, I think we tend to fall on the side that he was a widower, though.
The Pharisees had a requirement that they had to be married. So,
members of the Sanhedrin.
Right. So, he is very likely had to have been married, as opposed to single, which some of the church claims. But either one of those possibilities, Justin, I would think, would be possible.
And he said he'd suffer the loss of all things.
Yeah, but that's not talking about leaving your wife.
Oh, okay.
Mark, I can't see you over there.
Come on, Mark, move up.
Yeah, there's one right next to me.
There's a nice spot by Alyssa.
I can't leave that out.
Over here by Kelly.
Get your
keys,
son.
And he says this in verse 8. He says, to the unmarried and to the widows, I say that it is good for them to remain single as I am. But if they cannot exercise self-control, they should marry. Hi, Tori.
Hi.
Come on in. Have a seat somewhere.
Tori, do you
want to
say more?
That's my mom is coming too. Oh. She's here.
We've got room here.
Oh, good. We've got
Daisy
spots.
Can move too.
Oh, here we go.
Okay. There's two spots. Sorry, go ahead.
So he says, to the unmarried and to the widows, I say that it is good for them to remain single as I am. But if they cannot exercise self-control, they should marry. For it is better to marry than to burn with passion. And Tori, we are in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, and that was verse 9.
I forgot my Bible.
Oh.
It's okay.
There's a couple.
Do you have an app on your phone?
No, I don't.
No. There's some right here, too.
So, can we zoom out a little bit on this?
Yes.
Got
a few.
Jill, there's a spot right here.
Oh. I gotcha.
An agent spot.
Hey, Jill.
I was trying to slide in. Quietly.
Corinthians. So I think that we should zoom out a little bit on this too, because although it has a lot of good nuggets that are appropriate for married people, I think it also has a lot of good nuggets that are appropriate for our youngins too. And I think it starts out with this first verse where Paul says, "Now concerning the things whereof ye wrote unto me." And I think it's really important to focus on that, because within the body of Christ, there are people that have gone through experiences, who have walked before us, who have wisdom in certain areas that we need to know we can go to and ask questions. And so Paul, having experienced what it is to be married and maybe even to, you know, a couple who might be engaged, who's looking to get married, he is there to answer those questions. So I almost see this as he's setting himself up as, you know, yes, I am your minister. Yes, I'm here to deliver these truths, but I'm also here to mentor you in this walk, because there's going to be things that come up. There's going to be questions that come up, and you're not going to know how to navigate it, but I'm here also to guide you through these things, because this, you know, this entire chapter can be a bit uncomfortable, and it can feel like, you know what, none of this relates to me. I remember feeling like that when I was single. Before I got married, I thought, golly, Moses, this is, you know, you start feeling, whew, a little peaked during the service. Just want to crawl into your chair. So I just want to make sure that we're addressing some of the larger issues here, too, is that, you know, you're feeling it. Everybody's, like, looking down. Justin's like,
no, it was just the look that Justin gave you for laughing at.
So, anyway, I just want to keep that in perspective, too, that...
Shall we take five?
I think I need to go home.
I know, right?
But it's a mistake of the church not to address this kind of stuff, because the world's not going to stop addressing it just because the church decides to be prudish about it.
Oh, all us prudes over here. Thanks, Aaron.
I call you a prude. I said the church.
The guilty pig oinks.
Yeah, I think. You know, that isn't that a shame too? I mean, It's we can listen to music, we could go to the mall, we can see billboards, we can all these kinds of things, and it's normal. But
our eyes can't be shut because the world's going around.
Yeah, but then when we read about it in Christian circles, it's like all of a sudden we're just like, woo!
because that points out it's not normal.
Yeah.
Everything that we see, all the music that you're talking about, the billboards, doesn't coincide with this. It's against this. It's something wrong.
That's right.
That's true.
That's right.
What the world gives is perverted. What God gives is blessed.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And the wisdom of the Word of God is that it's the measurement against the world.
Mm-hmm.
And God is a benevolent God, just like it says, oh, when you're benevolent. God is benevolent. Mm-hmm. And he's the author of relationship.
True story. Can you say something else about that?
Well, the world always wants to take every gift that God has given us and give us a twisted, fake version of it.
Imitation, yeah. Mm-hmm. A counterfeit.
Mm-hmm. What was that?
A counterfeit. Yeah.
Yes, that's the word I was looking for. Thank you, Justin.
That's why intimacy in a relationship, in a marriage, brings contentment. But the sexual depravity in the world only increases appetite.
It's funny you say that, because I just finished, I'm in 2 Samuel right now. And Amnon just raped Tamar.
Mm-hmm.
David's son, Amnon, raped his sister, his half-sister, Tamar. And it talks about just how lovesick he was before he was able to have her. Like, oh, he couldn't think, he couldn't focus. I mean, he was a hound dog, right? And then all of a sudden, when he gets her, and he gets her the wrong way, he despised her. And she's like, he tells her to get out, and she tells him, she's like, don't kick me out. It'll be worse than what you've even done to me just now. Like, you could have asked our father. He would have happily given you to me. Like, let me stay. And he kicks her out, locks the door, and he makes, like, the humility of it even that much worse.
Isn't that the stuff that happened after Bathsheba incident?
Yes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It was all the bad stuff that went south after that.
Yeah. So, absolutely, like, it certainly has, what did you just say that prompted me to say that? Because within the confinements of marriage, it's different than outside the confinements of marriage.
Yeah, within a marriage, it brings contentment, but what the world offers, it only drives that... That desire deeper.
Yeah, the counterfeit never satisfies.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think it is counterfeit, but it also, you know, I think it's also taking things out of turn. You know, it's Adam and Eve taking of the forbidden fruit before they were told that they could. It's jumping out ahead of God to satisfy your own need instead of receiving the gift. It's like robbing Santa Claus instead of waiting for Christmas morning. Mm-hmm.
Come here, fat boy.
Empty the bag now.
Yeah, what you're talking about is with a wife you're looking for a life partner instead of predator or prey. I just want to conquer her, and once I conquer her, I don't want it anymore.
Right. Yeah, well, I mean, and he even says that when he talks about it's better to marry than to burn. And I don't think he's talking about hell. I think he's talking about that constant increase in desire. I mean, we see the same stuff with the other things of the flesh. If somebody's given over to gluttony, there's always something more. Like, I've eaten something sweet, so now I have to eat something salty. Well, now I've eaten something salty, and I have to eat something sweet. It feeds on itself.
Because
you're not trying to satisfy a hunger. You're trying to satisfy an emotion or something deeper.
Well, it's like Ecclesiastes, like the eye is not filled with seeing, the ear is not filled with hearing, the flesh is never satisfied.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the rich people just want more and more money, huh?
Yeah,
that's another example. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The lust, the corruption that is in the world through lust.
Yeah.
Yes. So people just want more and more stuff?
Mm-hmm. They just keep wanting more and more, like orders. Money orders.
Or just stuff, material possessions.
That's right, just build a house or whatever.
Okay, so verse 10 is cool, and it's different than like verses 12 and on, because in verse 10, Paul is quoting something that Jesus said, right, pretty definitively. He's saying, to the married I give this charge, not I, but the Lord. The wife should not separate from her husband, but if she does, she should remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband, and the husband should not divorce his wife. And Jesus talks about that, I think, in Matthew when he's challenged about, you know, why did Moses permit a bill of divorce? And then Jesus, you know, expounded to these Pharisees that God never intended man to separate what was brought together by him.
Well, here too, he's addressing a custom among the Romans, because the Romans, instead of being divorced, they would just leave if they were done with the marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's addressing that. That's also not okay.
It's called hardness of heart. You become hardened against your partner.
But then he says here in verse 12, with no less like authority, he says, to the rest I say, and I, not the Lord, that if any brother has a wife who is an unbeliever, and she consents to live with him, that he should not divorce her. If any woman has a husband who is an unbeliever, and he consents to live with her, she should not divorce him. For the unbelieving husband is made holy, is what the ESV says, and I think other versions says, is sanctified by the believing wife, and the unbelieving wife is sanctified or made holy because of her husband. Otherwise, your children would be unclean, but as it is, they are holy. So let's talk about this one. He's not quoting something Jesus ever said, but he has the authority as an apostle to say this and it be true. If anybody has a wife who is an unbeliever and she's consenting to live with him. She's willing to live with him in peace. He shouldn't divorce her. And therefore, she is considered sanctified in that marriage. What does that mean?
Set apart for God. I don't
know. He's the other half. She's the other half. If he's sanctified and they're together, she's sanctified.
What does sanctified mean?
So there's a theological term that refers to like salvation, but the word I think in the context of this means like different.
Different.
Yeah, different.
Okay.
Set apart, different.
Okay. So.
Are you gonna say something?
Oh, because
I mean, Wes, but
since she's a Christian, if he, she, or he's a Christian, and the other one isn't, but because of the marriage contract or bond.
Okay, well, let's just keep going because I think it kind of answers itself. Okay, the unbelieving husband is made holy, the one verse 14, because of his wife, and the unbelieving wife is made holy or sanctified because of her husband. Otherwise, your children would be unclean. But as it is, they are holy. But if the unbelieving partner separates, let it be so. In such cases, the brother or sister is not enslaved. God has called you to peace. For how do you know, wife, whether you will save your husband? Or how do you know, husband, whether you will save your wife? So I think the proper application of this, like, making the other one holy, is more so you have the ability to give them a godly influence in your home and in your life that they may not have outside of your home. Because they're not a believer. That marriage, the Holy Spirit can still work through that marriage because of a believing spouse. And it says, because you don't know if you are going to end up leading your spouse to come to that saving knowledge of Jesus.
And that's what happened to Smith Wigglesworth. His wife was a Christian first, and she led him to salvation, and then became a great preacher.
That's cool.
Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting to mention the children there, because I think that's the way it works with the children. If the parents are Christian and your child has not yet accepted Christ or had an experience with Christ, they are sanctified by the parents.
You know, when it says in Acts, when Paul and Barnabas were in prison, and he told the jailer, believe on Jesus Christ and you shall be saved and your house.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I mean, I guess that meant that it would.
So it's the Philippian jailer, read it in Acts, to find out that they took Paul and it's back to. So I'm sure they preached the gospel. That's my assumption.
Yeah.
And that they baptized them. Mm-hmm. Some people have said in a horse trough.
Oh.
I've heard that as a tradition, but I don't know.
I've seen them baptizing a horse trough recently.
You're kidding. Really?
Well, they have these big galvanized steel drinking things, and they haul it down to the church out in the parking lot. Yeah, I've seen it. And I've seen them baptized in the ocean in Hawaii too. They get out in the waves.
I think, the church, a lot of people have been lulled into a false sense of security with this set of scriptures. Because, just because one half of the couple is a believer doesn't automatically, lasso the other partner into heaven. And
when they have a better chance than they do with
Right. So you still have to see, and it's even with us in being in the world, we have to see ourselves as instruments that the Lord wants to use to bring others into a place of reconciliation with him. And so that spouse, their job is still to be somebody that can extend, reconciliation or restoration and be an example of what it is to be a believer. But it doesn't necessarily say, okay, you're with me, because the unbelieving spouse is still going to have to stand before judgment, and they can't say, oh, I'm with her. That doesn't work. And so, and
So, and I think verse 16 clearly indicates that because of how it says, what do you know, O wife, whether thou shalt save thy husband, or how knowest thou, O man, whether you will be there to be able to save thy wife? So that's talking about something that's potentially going to happen, not something that happens as a result of you have one half saved and the other half unsaved. Right.
Because he also says before that, if they just can't tolerate you because of your faith, let them leave.
If the unbelieving depart, let them go.
Because God's called you to peace.
Right.
Can I read the commentary?
Yeah, no, please do.
On 15, it says, permit him to cancel the marriage contract if he will, or her. Do not oppose their going if they desire to go. The Lord is able to provide for your affairs. And if that is the Lord's providence for you, so accept it. If the greater faithfulness, the worse the treatment from the unbelieving partner, that a separation might be necessary, let us remember that the Lord's counsel forewarned us. But then down in 16, or at the end of that, not under bondage, which is in the verse, but not free to marry again unless a divorce be secured on the one permissible ground. So my question is, what is the one permissible ground?
I disagree.
Adultery?
I disagree with that interpretation. I know that some do hold to that adultery is the only case, but he says here that the brother and sister is not enslaved in such cases. So
common term of salvation in the early church was the term brother and sister.
Right.
So members of the church.
He's saying a member of the church, if they are married to somebody who's not a Christian and they are divorced and left, that they're no longer enslaved to that relationship.
Okay, but adultery was the one reason for, justifiable reason for divorce, right?
That is the one that Jesus laid out, yes.
Yeah. Okay. So, if that's the only one that Jesus laid out, how can you make an exception?
I think Paul made an exception right here.
Who do you think's higher, Paul or Jesus?
Jesus. Then we're just going to throw out all the letters. That doesn't make sense either. Jesus didn't address every case. That's why Paul built on what Jesus wrote and said. Well, said, not wrote. So, like, you're going to throw out all of Romans?
Okay, Paul doesn't really address the fact that if they leave, that the believer then is free to marry.
So what does he mean by you're not enslaved in such cases, then? How do you interpret?
Do what now?
How do you interpret when he says, if the unbelieving one leaves, let him leave, the brother or sister is not enslaved in such cases? God has called us to peace.
He's not under bondage.
Okay. What verse is that, Aaron?
15.
It's 16. A brother or sister is not under bondage in such cases, but God hath called us to peace.
The only bondage in this...
Bondage is the bond of marriage.
Yeah.
So once that, if the unbeliever leaves, the believer still in the church is as single.
And I think they would be free to marry. But if a believing Christian leaves their husband or wife, because it mentions that earlier, right?
11.
Yeah.
That, in that wrong. Case, they are not allowed to remarry to anybody but their spouse.
Those are two believers.
Those are two different things.
Yeah.
And so I think because he's addressing the case, since these people, some of them were Romans, if they had previously left a spouse, they are not free to remarry. But if you are married and your spouse leaves you because they refuse to remain married to a believer, then you are free to marry.
Okay.
I think I can make a argument for that. For adultery is easy, and then for abuse. Abuse is the other case where I think a married person is able to leave. But my advice for anybody who's concerned about the adultery thing is just stay single. And don't remarry until your spouse, the former spouse, remarries. Because if they've left you or you've divorced and they've remarried, then you know that they've already broke the marriage bond with adultery. If that's your concern, It's a little too practical for.
Oh, I understand. It's
get
just,
the argument.
It seems like it's just you're waiting for a way out, but.
Yeah.
I understand your argument.
Yeah. Well, and you have to follow your conviction in that case. But I think those are the three cases where the marriage balance has been broken.
Moving on.
Good discussion.
Yeah, it's important, and it comes up a lot. There's been a history in the church of forcing, and it's pretty much almost always women to stay with abusive husbands because Jesus did not specifically say you can't divorce. To the point that, I mean, women have been very, very violently beaten because they felt like they had to stay with their husband.
But if someone happened to be deceased, the God, then you could remarry?
Yes, okay. Yes, four. Thank you. That would be the fourth one. For sure.
That would count.
Unless you're Mormon. Yeah. Mormons are married for a certain people.
Well, then they could get married more than one person, so it's okay.
Yeah.
It's all good.
But only if they're married in the temple.
Yeah.
They have to be sealed in the temple with the whole thing.
The whole thing.
So here we go. Let's talk about being content with living as we are called. Verse 17. Only let each person lead the life that the Lord has assigned to him and to which God has called him. This is my rule in all the churches. Was anyone at the time of his call already circumcised? Let him not seek to remove the marks of circumcision. Was anyone at the time of his call uncircumcised? Let him not seek circumcision. For neither circumcision counts for anything, nor uncircumcision, but keeping the commandments of God. Each one should remain in the condition in which he was called.
Hold on. So, there's something interesting you may not realize. In Moses' law, were they required to be circumcised? In the Torah, were they required to be circumcised?
Yeah.
And yet in 19, he says, circumcision is nothing, uncircumcision is nothing, but what matters is keeping the commandments of God. Which commandments is he talking about?
The new covenant.
He's talking about the new covenant, and therefore by the commandments of God, he is called Jesus God.
Say that again.
Those commandments. So here, when he says keeping the commandments of God, if he's talking about the new covenant, he's talking about the commandments that Jesus gave. He is referring
therefore,
to Jesus
is God.
God.
Okay.
Cool. I haven't seen that one yet.
There's certain cults that deny Jesus' divinity.
Oh, yeah. Well,
and
okay.
even using the same Bible. So that's kind of a.
It's good to have
respond to
a
that.
Few of these in the back pocket
yeah.
when it comes up.
That's why he was pointing out.
Okay, that's a good point.
So each one should remain in the condition in which he was called. Were you a bondservant when you were called, or a slave? Don't be concerned about it. But if you can gain your freedom, by all means, avail yourself the opportunity. But like the goal here, he's saying, is like it's not to change your status in life. If you can, great, but don't make that your focus. For he who was called in the Lord as a slave is a free man, a freedman of the Lord. Likewise, he who was free when he was called is a bondservant of Christ. You were bought with a price. Do not become bondservants of men. So, brothers, in whatever condition each was called, let them remain with God.
There's one major problem with that. After that first group, the entire church would die. What was it, the Shakers?
Yeah.
If you converted single and stay single, then you don't have a church left after what generation. It's all gone.
I thought they were also avoiding marital relations too, though.
Yes, they were.
Yeah.
But that's what I'm saying. He's saying if you're single when you're converted, then don't change. So you have kids.
Well,
your kids become Christian, don't get married because you converted before you married.
But if that interpretation is true for this, then everything he said from 1 through 17 is all garbage. Because he specifically said, if it's better to marry than to burn, which is to change your circumstances. What he's talking about here is not to allow your natural circumstances to determine your ability to walk with God.
Correct.
That's correct.
Well, and there's also a natural tendency, I think, in all of us to want to make ourselves righteous. And so, specifically, I was thinking about that witch lady that she was a tattoo artist. What was her name? Kat Von D.
Kat Von D.
And she was converted. Like, she has this beautiful, beautiful testimony. And she's covered from head to toe in tattoos. And she's blacking it all out. And I think that, you know, if that's what the Lord's telling you to do, fine. But when we come to the Lord, we come
as we are.
As we are. We can't undo the past. That's part of our testimony. And so, like, that, we just shouldn't put ourselves under the bondage of, I've got to undo everything. Like, I'm circumcised. Oh, no. I need to become uncircumcised. How do you do that? How do you go backwards?
Well, historically, that was a practice that they tried to do.
Yeah.
To stretch it out and reverse it.
Yeah.
So, it's just, you know, again, that goes to making ourselves, like, that's self-salvation. I need to make myself
good. I'll text you an article to show you.
Oh, please don't.
But yes.
Natalie's like, all right, you're
right. It's out of satiric. And I mean, the people get really stuck in some of those things too.
Yes.
I mean, I've heard men say, and sometimes women say, that they don't feel like they can really be fully committed to God until they get married, which is foolish. Because you learn to abide in every situation.
You know, I remember thinking that as a child, and I know my kids have thought that, you know, well, and when I'm an adult, when I have more independence, when I'm not dependent on somebody else, you know, then I'll really be sold out for God. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking that as a kid, like, I'm just, you know, just a kid. But again, that is not, that's looking at your station in life and saying, I can't be everything God's called me to be because of, you know, my circumstances, when we've got to pursue the Lord and allow Him to create the circumstances. So,
well, it's like those people that are always waiting for life to calm down. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I'll do this when.
Right.
I'll quit smoking when.
I'll quit smoking
right.
when. I'll do this
I'll
when.
I'll have a baby when I can afford it.
The when right. never happens.
No. Right.
So if you're making your walk with God dependent on circumstance, like,
mm-hmm.
It's never going to get there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like, I have a friend that keeps saying, well, I'll get to that when life gets less busy. She's been saying that for 15 years. So, like,
it's not
going to
get
right, but you're never going to.
Right.
Kind of mentioned this to Mark here. Years ago, when I was a kid, we used to get the Christmas tree and cut the end off. We would take that end and make candle holders out of it, take the wood burner, put T-U-I-T, and hand them out as gifts. And people say, what's that? It's a round to it.
What?
A round to it. I'll do it when I get around to it. Right? Here's your round to it.
That's corny. That's corny.
But I actually did it.
Yeah, yeah.
So 25.
Definitely made them think about it.
Concerning the betrothed, I have no command from the Lord, but I give my judgment as one who by the Lord's mercy is trustworthy. Mm-hmm. I think that in view of the present distress, it is good for a person to remain as he is. What's the present distress he's talking about?
Commentary, maybe.
Persecution from the wicked Roman Empire that was killing people indiscriminately and even like for entertainment.
Mm-hmm. I was going to mention earlier that maybe it'd be interesting to see how the word believer translates, because there were people that waited until their deathbed to make a commitment to God, because doing so was a death sentence.
We knew that that was the case as of the conversion of Constantine. I don't know if that was the case at this point, but man, I had it and then I lost it. Oh, so we now, reading through Corinthians, we take the fact that they were called Christians as being like, yes, this is when they first got called Christians, but that was a derogatory term.
It was an insult.
Yep. They're calling them baby Christ.
Mm-hmm.
oh, look at all the baby Christ. They were making fun of them. So they were facing a lot of persecution.
Which is why his advice here is like, it sounds a little weird in modern times, or to at least an American perspective. He says, I think that in the view of the present distress, it is good for a person to remain as he is. Are you bound to a wife? Don't seek to be free. Are you free from a wife? Don't seek a wife. But if you do marry, you have not sinned. And if a betrothed woman marries, she has not sinned. Yet those who marry will have worldly troubles, and I would spare you that. This is what I mean, brothers. The appointed time has grown very short. From now on, let those who have wives live as though they had none. And those who
weep,
mourn as they were not mourning. And those who rejoice as though they were not rejoicing. And those who buy as though they had no goods. And those who deal with the world as though they had no dealings with it. For the present form of this world is passing away. I want you to be free from anxieties. The unmarried man is anxious about things of the Lord and how to please God. But the married man is anxious about worldly things and how to please his wife. And his interests are divided. And that's because, like, as far as they knew, like, they were all going to get wiped off the face of the earth.
And I've often wondered, too, if they had a belief that, you know, the world was changing and God was coming back within their lifetime.
Perhaps.
I think it's very likely that we, some of them, felt like it was imminent.
I mean, Jesus had told them about John, not all you'll pass away before I come back. So I think it...
And there's good evidence that the church interpreted Revelation as being something present. So the 666, in the Greek, when they translated it to Aramaic, they changed it to 616. And 666 in the Greek, so Greek uses letters for numbers. And 666 spells out Nero. Mm-hmm. And in Aramaic, 616 is what spells out Nero. Nero was the man who was slaughtering all the Christians. So it heavily suggests that the interpretation at the time was that Revelation was giving hope to people that there was hope in the future and not to give in to the man of sin.
Revelation is progressive. They learn more as time went by.
I'm not saying that it's only to be interpreted that way.
Yes.
The same way that in the Old Testament there were prophecies about Jesus that saw a partial fulfillment at the time, but Jesus was the full fulfillment. The same with Revelation, that there was an interpretation at that time, but there's a greater interpretation through the whole of time.
So I'm going to divert here for a quick second.
Yes, sir.
And talk about what you just brought up with Hebrew words do have a numerical value. I don't know how to calculate that value, but it is a thing. Mm-hmm. You guys ever wondered, like, why Jesus told Peter to forgive 70 times 7 times? Like, it's just kind of random. Like, here Peter is like, should I forgive him 7 times? And Jesus is like, how about 70 times 7? Well, listen to this. 490, the number of perfection. When Jesus taught his disciples the true meaning of forgiveness, he may have been saying more than we Westerners realize. Peter asked Jesus, Lord, how often shall my brother sin against me and I forgive him? Up to 7 times? And Jesus said to him, I don't say up to 7 times, but 70 times 7. Peter thought he was being very spiritual by being willing to forgive someone up to 7 times. So Jesus' response commanding him to forgive someone up to 490 times must have been quite a shock. Everything Jesus did and said was very purposeful. He never wasted a word. So the number of times he instructs us to forgive has to have some kind of deeper significance, but what is it? Well, every word in Hebrew has a numerical value, and these values frequently communicate deeper insights. That is certainly the case here. The number 490 is the numerical value of the biblical Hebrew word tamim, which means complete, perfect, or finished. A person who can't forgive will always live an imperfect and incomplete life that lacks a true understanding of the finished, gracious work of the cross. The number 490 is also the value of the Hebrew phrase let your heart be perfect. That's from 1 Kings 8:61. Forgiving helps make us complete and is a key to perfecting our hearts before the Lord. But there's some even deeper connections in Hebrew. The word for my nativity, which is Moladati, and the word Bethlehem, the city where Messiah was born, and means house of bread, each individually adds up to 490. This makes perfect sense since Jesus was born so that we might be forgiven. And forgiveness is associated with bread in the Lord's Prayer, which says, give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our debts as we also have forgiven our debtors. So just like a person can't live without their daily bread, an individual can't survive without forgiveness.
Ooh, that's good. You might want to forward that to everybody in the list. That's
good. And there's a later chapter in here about taking communion unworthily. Because of all the infighting and quarreling and bickering, he says you're doing it to your own death. Your own damnation.
I think what's interesting about this part, he's very clear about, this is not a command from the Lord, just giving you my advice. But I feel like some denominations have taken this very
yes, and literally. Put people in bondage. Yes. Well, and not because they've tried to. No, I like specifically what he says in here. He says, listen, go either way. This is my advice. But if you choose this, it's not a sin. And I think that's neat. I like that he does that. He says, you know, if you do marry, you have not sinned.
Well, the motivation's in verse 35. He says, I say this for your own benefit, not to lay any restraint upon you, mm-hmm. but to promote good order and to secure your undivided devotion to God.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's what it comes, because I think a lot of times, you know, people will think, and this is something in the church that I grew up in, I remember that my kindergarten teacher drawing a circle of time on the board, and she said, God's going to come back in like this tiny little sliver of time. And I thought, oh my gosh, I'm never going to have time to grow up. I'm never going to get married. I'm never going to have children. Like, the time is this short. And, you know, that puts fear in people. And when you're focused on your fear, you're not focused on the Lord. And so what he's saying is focus on the Lord. So, just to undergird what you were saying.
Like I said, I think from the very first century, mm-hmm. there have been groups of people that have believed that Jesus was coming back tomorrow. I mean, all through, for the last 2,000 years, there's been somebody that, oh, I did this math and I won't, and he's coming back on this date.
Yeah.
And focused on the date, like you said, rather than on what God was doing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and I think that also kind of goes with what he was saying here. It's like in our dealings with God and our relationship with God, we have to be conscious of how our attention can be split and not allow that whole idea that we're just going to wait for this thing to happen and be consumed with what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
I think Jesus even warned about that, didn't he? He said, no man knows but the Father.
Yeah.
Why try to contemplate it?
Right.
Anyway, we should all live as if today's the day he's coming.
Mm-hmm.
We should live all of this in the time that we're in to be mm-hmm. the best we can
mm-hmm.
as God gives us grace. And I know in Sharon and I were at a Bible study, and people wanted to get married for the rapture rush on the Feast of Trumpets on September 15th, 1976 or 77?
75.
So, thank you, dear.
I just think it's funny. Eventually, somebody's going to be right. I knew it.
Well, clock's right twice a day.
Exactly.
Well, in reality, he came back on the Pentecost and is living within us. We need to live as if Jesus is already here and we are carrying out the will of his kingdom.
He's going to come on the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And split it in two.
Yeah, we're supposed to be his heaven. On earth.
Yes.
Yeah.
That was my point. Not waiting for.
It's not a place that we're going to go to someday. It's supposed to be the thing that we're bringing to the world right now.
Yeah.
So here we go, we'll close it up. If anyone thinks that he is not behaving properly toward his betrothed, if his passions are strong, and it has to be, let him do as he wishes, let him marry. It is no sin. But whoever is firmly established in his heart, being under no necessity, but having his desire under control, and has determined this in his heart, to keep her as his betrothed, he will do well. So then he who marries his betrothed does well, and he who refrains from marriage will do even better. A wife is bound to her husband as long as he lives. But if her husband dies, she is free to be married to whom she wishes, only in the Lord. Can't marry a heathen. Yet in my judgment, she is happier if she remains as she is, and I think that I too have the Spirit of God. See, he's nice enough to share his opinion, but he doesn't force it on. He doesn't force his gift of singleness upon others. He just gives his perspective.
Well, I also appreciate that he gives his reasoning for why he's thinking that. I think that's a good lesson for us. All too often we'll make a rule or a proclamation without giving anybody any reason why we said that. It doesn't do anybody good. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's good.
But yeah, the last principle you touched on, that Justin, is that we're not to marry an unbeliever.
Mm-hmm. Knowing what you know, yeah. It's one thing if you got married ignorantly.
Sure, it's one thing if you married it got yes. It's also another thing if you married somebody and you thought they were a believer, but they weren't really a believer.
Correct.
That's a warning about not being unevenly yoked.
Yeah, well, I mean, the last girl I dated before Alyssa was a Catholic girl, and I thought, well, she's a Christian. And Catholics can be good Christians too, but she was not a good Catholic either. And so it was that said, no, I'm not doing that again. I won't date anybody else unless they're actually committed to God.
This subject is a lot more complex than we're covering tonight.
Yes.
Because it goes into the issue of contract. And I think if we live each day as unto the Lord, like he's coming, and don't do anything hastily to say, well, I better get this sin in before he comes. You know, that's not the way to think.
You heard of me coming in any day now, so make sure you get married right now.
Yeah.
As fast as you can.
Well, and I think if we're looking at the, you know, it addresses marrieds, unmarrieds, it addresses all these different topics. You know what I really appreciate the most about this is just the idea that as believers we can seek wise counsel. Mm-hmm. You know, Paul is standing here and I counted up 5 times. I had never seen this when I read the chapter before until tonight, about how many times he says, this isn't, you know, a commandment from the Lord, but this is my judgment as somebody who has followed
and
who is trustworthy, who's looking out for your best interests, who's seeking, you know, the kingdom. And so I think it's just a plug that, you know, there are people, you know, we can always seek wise counsel. We can always seek people who have walked before us. Obviously, and somebody said it in the sermon, are you going to ask marriage advice from the newlyweds, or are you going to ask marriage advice from, you know, the folks that have been married for 70 years? You know, just knowing where good counsel is, and usually you can tell because you see the fruit in their life. So,
as the old saying goes, you don't need to drink poison and the nose will kill you.
That's a good saying.
That is a good saying. Good job. Is that it?
Well, Mark says we'll drink poison and not be touched.
Let's say, let's just pluck that scripture out of context.
Yeah, pretty much. That was added way later anyway, so.
Oh. Well, that was good. Awesome. So next week, we're moving on up.
Here's your piece of Justin marriage advice.